Ms. Ostapenko has no challenges remaining.
Let's pick up another fun one. This is not on the discipline side of things, but I wanted to ask about some of the British players who are going on in the tour right now. Notably, let's start with Andy Murray. Let's finish this Dubai theme. Andy Murray loses in Dubai to Hugo Humbert, who's having a great year. Humbert surging towards top 10, which I predicted on this show, but my year-end show with Ricky, I think I said that Humbert would be top 10 in 2024. So that is looking good. He's definitely trending up. We'll see if he gets there. Probably won't, but still feeling okay about that pick, given the momentum. He loses, and he goes to press. And he's been playing a lot and losing a lot in 2024. Andy Murray only won a couple matches, I think, and lots of losses. And he gets asked, why don't you paint the picture of Andy Murray and tell us what he said and what's been going on with him this year?
So, yeah, in Dubai, after his straight sets loss to Humbert, another loss, another day, another loss, Murray came into press and was asked again about his future and what he was thinking about in terms of retirement. And his response was, I'm likely not going to play past this summer. I get asked about it after every single match that I play, every single tournament that I play. I'm bored of this question, to be honest. I'm not going to talk about that between now and whenever the time comes for me to stop. But yes, I don't plan on playing much past this summer. I think the striking thing to me is just that he started this year hoping that this wouldn't be the case. I remember seeing him as I first spoke to him in Kooyong before the Australian Open, and he was saying he was talking a lot about his serve and how he'd realized in the off season that was really the issue that was stopping him from playing his best tennis, and he'd worked really hard on his serve, and he just seemed in a very light and good mood. And seemed, that much as bad as things had been in the second half of last year, there'd been positives as well that year, particularly in the first half, the Australian Open last year, making the Doha final. And I think he felt that there was still good tennis in him, particularly with the way he'd been playing in practice. But this year has just been a disaster, really. And he's struggling to win matches. He's been competitive in some of them, but when he has been competitive, he struggled to close out matches. And so now we're in the third month of the year, he's won two matches. I think at this point, as things are currently going, that's really the only destination. That's the only conclusion that probably, if this continues, there's no point of playing. I do think that in the back of his mind, he's still hoping that there'll be some sort of turn in his form.
That he'll find
some decent level, that he'll come to Wimbledon, that he'll maybe have a good grass season, reach the second week of Wimbledon, and then he'll be like, "Hey, I said likely. I'm continuing.
I say lots of things. He's he had an on court retirement ceremony once before years ago. And he's still kicking. So yeah, it was just interesting to me like how he sort of felt like he almost was acting like he was being bullied into saying it. In this way, he had this sort of tone of like, I don't want to say this, but I'm getting sick of this question, so I'll put a time on it or say I'm only going to play a couple months, which basically was not exact time. You don't know if that means Wimbledon or US Open, whatever months might mean. But yeah, it's interesting too. I was talking to Andrea Pekovic about this actually, because Pekovic, I did a book event. You still get the book, by the way, Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice. Haven't mentioned it yet today. In Manhattan, and she was there, and she just wrote a book in German that hopefully comes out in English. If you read German, you should get it. But it's basically about her last year on tour and sort of coming to the realization that she was going to stop. I mentioned, and I was talking to her, this is a weird way to sort of name drop for no reason, but I mentioned to her John Isner last year, who had no intention of retiring at the start of the year, but basically he just had a bad year, and he was not winning matches, was getting a few little minor injuries, but mostly not winning when he was playing, and fell out of the top 100. And so he retired, basically. Probably maybe like a year ahead of what his initial schedule was going to be. And you don't always get to choose, is the point of that example. Like, you sometimes the tour will decide when you're done. Whether that's Gasquet just falling out of the top 100, whether that's what Isner had. There's no reason, Andy Murray's a bigger star than those players, but there's no reason why he should get to control his own destiny in tennis on a certain level. If he can't hack it, the tour will say to him, you're out. And Murray has an appetite for playing down, for playing challengers. I think his ranking is largely bolstered, honestly, by these two challengers he won last summer on grass.
Three.
Yeah, three. Okay, yeah. So, or one, two on grass, anyway, and then one other.
One on clay, yeah.
Yeah. So, which was, and those were good wins. I mean, he beat Tommy Paul in the final of that clay one. So that was the top 20 win. There's, we've had moments, yeah, but like, it just seems like maybe it runs out. You know, this time comes for everyone eventually. And, you know, even on the last show, actually, like even Djokovic, you know, like takes this, this is obviously, we think, way down the road for him, but, you know, he loses this unexpected, in this really, you know, stark fashion to Sinner in Australia. And maybe time catches up to him eventually this year. We don't know. We'll see when it happens. And maybe just for Murray, in some of these matches he's lost to players who and most of them who have had good years, who he kind of lost to, like, lesser-known players who are trending up. You look at his list, like Umber, who's been playing great, Jakub Menšík, who had a really good week in Doha, who he lost to, and Thomas Mahach, who's played well this year as well. And the Benoit Paire loss is pretty bleak. I mean, there's no sugarcoat in the Benoit Paire loss.
Oh, yeah.
But other players, Dimitrov, Dimitar, these are players who's lost to recently. These are players who are playing well. So, yeah, it was sort of a bleak moment. But if I can pivot to happier British tennis to get to some you've been saying on Andy before I get to the happier story of this weekend.
Just that I don't think it's everyone wants to finish, you know, on a high, winning matches, you know, on a glorious ending. Everyone want, and that's what everyone wants for their favorite players as well, from the perspective of fans. But if this is how it ends, I don't think it's sad, that sad, really. What would be worse is if he couldn't walk anymore.
Yeah.
The more I watch tennis, the more I appreciate a player just playing until the end, until they can no longer produce the level that they used to.
Yeah.
That, to me, that's a satisfying ending compared to. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but, you know, we talk about players finishing at the top of their game, but like a Barty, as satisfying as that was for her, of course, and, you know, I'm not criticizing her decision or anything. Of course, as someone who watches tennis, you wanted to see more. Of course, with Murray and the hip, and there's a lot of, you know, ifs and what could have been if that, all of that hadn't happened to him, but he still had a great career and he's done so much, and there's not really much what to do.
He did his best, and eventually diminishing best as he gets older won't be good enough, and that's fine. I didn't, there is some beauty in that as well. Another player I'll mention who's just dropped off, who hasn't retired yet, but it's Diego Schwartzman, another player who just went from sort of abruptly from being a top, you know, 20 level player roughly, Schwartzman, to just kind of not being able to win matches anymore. You just sort of turn this corner in your career, and especially with Schwartzman, I think especially it's stark because he can't win free points. If he's losing a step or something, I haven't watched enough of him to really know honestly what's going on with his game, but he always overachieved in a lot of ways because of his undersized nature in men's tennis, and that sort of no longer conjure that magic. Okay, you know, you run out of the magic dust and it's over and you had a good run. It does make me nervous, honestly, when some of these players are playing beyond, I would say explicitly, I'm thinking of Venus Williams, who's on the order of play as we record this today, later today in Indian Wells. It's sort of like, I don't know what the upside is here. If she wants to keep playing, tournaments are happy to have her, by all means. But it, just especially having seen that US Open match against Minin, where she got really, really kind of, not embarrassed, but got her doors blown off, basically, by this non-spectacular player in Minin. Who she said was amazing, but who
top
but,
10 player,
yeah, in this
one or what number one,
yeah, she said all those things. It just sort of, it makes me nervous and just sort of makes me, yeah, anyway, I'm not trying to chase anybody out of the sport. Keep playing as long as you want, Andy, Venus, whoever, but just as a yeah. viewer, I don't buy the legacy tarnishing that also came out last month, this article that she got upset about, the BBC article by Carradine, the idea of tarnishing legacy. I think everyone kind of rejects legacy things, whatever he does, whoever he flops to in the future, Andy, I say with love, will not change the fact that he won Wimbledon twice. You know, like, none of the legacy, as a British man, did all these great things and two gold medals and everything he meant to people. Well, none of that will change because he has taken some L's to some unspectacular players later on.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the same time, like, you just hope that it's worth it to them and that they're not risking injury, honestly, too. I worry about Venus with the injury.
That's what I was going to say, yeah. With Venus, I'm more concerned that she's just barely been able to stay fit, and every other match there's some physical complaint. And
that fall she had at Wimbledon, like, still, like, it screams, yeah. Still haunts me. Even if she finished that match, I was like, oh God. Because, like, she just doesn't have, as of, you know, she's turning 44 this year. Trying to play singles tennis in this era of WTA at 44 is perilous, I think.
He's been playing for 30 years.
Yes,
he's been pro for 30 years.
That's really nuts. I wanted to pivot to the Happier British Tour just to do some results recaps. I was alluding to Katie Bolter, who won in San Diego, the 500 event there. She wins. She's someone who I first watched her play meaningfully, I think, at Wimbledon in 2021 when she played Aryna Sabalenka on center court in a really fun three-set match. Sabalenka was the number two seed, and that was I was really impressed by her there and the sort of court craft she has now. And now, as a lot of players do, who are sort of variety players, she's really kind of honed her game to be much more straightforward and just hitting the ball really well and very, very just nice-looking game that she plays and very effective. Lots of top 50 wins in San Diego to win that tournament, her first title. You've followed Bolter for a while longer, I know, but what do you make of her merging here?
Yeah, I'm not particularly surprised. She's had a strange path where she broke into the top 100 relatively early, end of 2018, start of 2019. She had this dramatic, Billie Jean King Cup tie against Kazakhstan in 2019, and it turned out that she won a match. She won a match and then lost a really tight match to Putintseva. But it turned out that she was playing with a back stress fracture. So having only just gotten into the top 100 a few months earlier, suddenly she was out for 7 months and back into the ITFs. And really since then, it was just, there were a lot of injuries, but also she'd appear again in like Billie Jean King Cup, or she'd get wild cards, you know, like to the match you mentioned, and she'd play really well against top players, but bringing it day in, day out was difficult. I think she, in a weird way, she had a slice of luck last year in Nottingham, where she won her first WTA title, but didn't play anyone in the top 130. It was almost like a British national event in the
end.
Yeah,
I remember that.
She played three, I think she played Dart, Watson, and then Burridge in a row, the final three rounds of a WTA title. But that propelled her back into the top 100, and now she's back with the top players. She's comfortable. I think she's learned a lot just week after week, just playing these big events, even when she hasn't really done, she hasn't had many incredible runs, but she's been consistent, beating players she should do. You know, here she is. She has the weapons, big serve, big forehand. I mean, she's good on both sides actually. And as you said, she's a clean hitter, nice compact strokes, and yeah, she has the confidence now. She has a potent game, and you can go a long way with it. And now she's top 30, which is, like I said, it's not surprising, but it's kind of crazy that she's top 30 and she's gone from being, I think last year she was as low as 157 in like, I want to say May, and now she's 27th. So that's a big, big, big leap forward.
I forgot one early memory of Katie Bolter I had, which was the British press. And I was like openly furious at them this day. I remember this. Dragging her for withdrawing from French Open and getting half her prize money. And she was getting dragged. Yeah. And it was like, what are you doing? Like, this player is like in the top 100, has earned this prize money, has not made much money in her career at all. And who knows if she will. Who knows if this back when she's at this point, it's like career ending. I mean, who knows? And the way that she was just being like savaged was just like bizarre and, say, lightly misogynistic. It was just really strange how that there's like this nobody, honestly, at this point, was getting so brutally handled by the press. I thought that was ridiculous. I remember yelling at people in the long lawn seating section, watching some first round match, being like, what are you guys doing? This is ridiculous. Shut up about Katie Bolter. She does not deserve any of this. Should we go over some other February results, some top line results?
Well, I guess we should note, obviously, that she won a 500 the same week as Alex de Minaur, her boyfriend.
We'll get to Demon on the middle. We'll do women first. But yes, they did. Yes, yeah, so it was a nice Lady romantic first, story yeah. of the... But I give Demon credit. I'll send to this part. Sir Alex de Minaur wins Acapulco the night before Bolter wins her San Diego final. And he flies to Tijuana, I think he said he was doing, at like 4 a.m., and then cross the border via land, which can be a headache sometimes. I don't know how it went for him, from Tijuana into San Diego. They're right next to each other, right across the border. And that's what he said he was doing, his itinerary, and made it there for the final. And was, you know, they had some cute moments about it. They're not like the most like high profile in terms of like flaunting their relationship, but they've been together for a while. Bolter and Demon are. She always likes my tweets about anytime I mention him. She's always liking the tweets. So she's, people are rooting for them for sure. Sort of the clear new power couple in tennis at this point by ranking. They definitely have the lowest combined ranking of any couple we know of in tennis. So good for them. Other women's results to get to the women. sorry, Bolter beat a lot of top players, including Pagula, who came back. Pagula, should mention, since we last did a show, split with her coach, David Witt, a longtime coach, and it's interesting to see what she does this next month. I'm very curious to keep an eye on Pagula, because that was a surprising situation for sure that a lot of people didn't see coming. Before that, there was a 2,000 events in the Middle East. Actually, I'll start at the beginning of the Middle East and go this way. So we have a 500 Abu Dhabi won by Elena Rybakina over Kasatkina in the final. Rybakina is doing well. Then comes Qatar. Or actually, I'll mention also in Transylvania, Cluj-Napoca, won by Karolina Pliskova, who went on a sudden great surge after falling out of the top 70. Pliskova plays down, wins Transylvania, and then makes a run to the semifinals of Doha the next week. And so wins, like, I think, like 10 matches or something along the lines of like 10 matches in 12 days. I don't remember the exact number, but a ton of matches, including beating Naomi Osaka in the quarterfinals of Doha by the book. But Iga Świątek wins that Doha final over Rybakina. And it's, I think, easy to see this as sort of like, okay, this is Iga. This is a real testament to the top of the sport and, you know, where it's at right now. And Iga not doing well at the slams, but asserting herself as the best player everywhere else, at least at this point.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
And then we get to Dubai, the second WTA event, and Świątek makes the semis again, but she loses to Anna Kalinskaya, who's had a really strong start to the year, winning a lot of matches. Kalinskaya had also beaten Coco Gauff in the round before that, and had a bunch of solid wins, made quarterfinals of Australia, that open top half, you may remember. And then Kalinskaya is not the tournament winner, though. Tournament was won by Jasmine Paolini, who is the diminutive Italian, who wins dramatic final 4-6, 7-5, 7-5. And a sort of, after you get this sort of real top line WTA result the week before, with Świątek beating Rybakina in a final of 1,000, next week you get Paolini beating Kalinskaya. And obviously, great result for Paolini and Kalinskaya, but Paolini especially, who's been playing well. But it's just a weird sort of data point for the tour to have Paolini winning 1,000, I think it's fair to say. It's sort of just a bit of a scramble. And Sabalenka was in this tournament too and lost her first match. I'm forgetting to who. She lost, let me see if I can pull this up. She lost to
Vekic.
Vekic, yes, first round. Yeah, bageled in the third by Vekic. That's right. So what do you make of this pair of results in the women's tennis and where the sort of game is right now?
Well, first of all, from Świątek, I think it was good that she just moved on from the Australian Open quickly and performed very well and won a WTA 1000 title. If you remember, it took her until the end of the year, last year, to win a 1000. And then, of course, she won the WTA finals after that. But yeah, I think that was good for her. I do think that the new format with two 1000 events back-to-back is, I don't know, it just feels, obviously, it happens throughout the year, at least it used to, when Madrid and Rome were 1,000, well, 1 week events, and also Cincinnati and Toronto, but it just feels very early, wouldn't you say? And
well, there's just so many of them, yeah. And like, it seems to be more largely in women's tennis, and men's too a bit, but women's more pointedly, I think. It seems to be like point inflation happening here. Like, some of these tournaments just feel, and it's not overvalued by who showed up, because actually the Dubai and Doha both had 1,000 caliber draws. So it's not quite that issue, but, you know, so many tournaments are getting upgraded lately.
Yeah.
Either from 500 to 1,000 or from 250 to 500, that there's going to be just a lot more points and sort of there'd be point inflation happening here. Like, you know, Linz being a 500 with really not a 500 level field. I'm sure there'll be more tournaments like that. I mean, San Diego, not the world's strongest 500. There's such range in quality of the fields in the 500s, especially right now.
Yeah.
Where, like, Charleston will be a super strong 500, but then you'll get like Strasbourg the week before the French Open, which is going to be a super weak 500, you have to think. Yeah, it's just an odd time. And how about this? I'm going to talk about the Golden Swing in a second for the men. Sure. It's just some of the rankings and the points don't always line up.
It's funny to me, though, that clearly the reason there are two 1,000 events here is because the WTA is trying to put the top players in the same tournaments more often to get, you know, to accentuate the rivalries, to get a Świątek Sabalenka, Świątek Gauff playing each other more often. And yet the very next week you have Paolini Kalinskaya in the final. I think from Paolini's perspective, or Paolini, I really enjoy her. She's a hard worker. She's been growing gradually over the past few years, and you see that reflected in her ranking. And she's, even though she's small and diminutive, she's learned how to use her forehand, and she played very well to win the title. And again, in that final tight three set match, she showed a lot of metal and mental toughness to come back after Kalinskaya served for it. But I was thinking that the top 10 right now in the WTA. Obviously, the top four players are doing very well, even if, you know, most of them had a bad week that week. But from 6 to 10, particularly like from the year end, this might be the weakest it's ever been on the tour. This is a a hot take.
I want to use that name them meme. Yes, I'll name the top five are Świątek, Sabalenka, Gauff, Rybakina, Pegula, the current top five. And then below that is Jabeur, Zhang Qinwen, Vondroušová, Ostapenko, and Sakkari. And I agree. I'll even throw Mukova and Kasatkina and Hadamaya in there at 11, 12, 13. These are not all-timers.
Yeah, and I don't just mean because, like, as players in general, but also their form.
Jabeur is exactly
injured, still got Wimbledon in her head. Vondroušová still trying to back up, you know, follow up Wimbledon. Mukova injured, just has been barely been able to play since the French Open final. Sakkari is just in, you know, just really, really struggling. It's, you mentioned Pegula. She has split in with Witt and David Witt, and now David Witt's with Sakkari. And yeah, Ostapenko's, I think Ostapenko's been playing well, but she's, of course, she's Ostapenko. It's, she's still going to have great weeks and not as great weeks. But yeah, it's just a bit of a, it's a bit messy. And that means that when the very top players aren't performing at their very best, then there's opportunity for a Kalinskaya or Jasmine Paolini to be facing each other in the final. So it's just, particularly as I do believe that there's that lower down, that there's more depth than even if they're, you know, they're not able to sustain it enough to get into a top 10. It's a strange times.
Yeah, it's very strange times in a lot of ways. I still look at, honestly, I don't mean this personally for her, but look at Vondroušová, and just that result is just remains, I think, so brutal for women's tennis as a thing. And this is one of the things, not that she didn't deserve, she won the seven matches, but like, she didn't do anything with it afterwards. It's not clear that she will. And it just seemed like a kind of, from the, I want to get existential with the sport here for a second, because like, I was thinking this as I was watching processing the Netflix slam, which happened too. That's another thing that happened this week. And I did a thread about this, and I think you said you wanted to talk about it as well. But basically, like, where women's tennis is, seems to be like, you know, in sort of a state of the union sense, it's not doing well. Like, I just don't get the sense that, like, that, and a lot of it, like I say with Vondroušová, I meant to mention her from the point of saying it's out of their control, right? On the results side of things. The WTA can't really do anything meaningfully to change who's in the top 10 and how well they're playing at any given point, right? That's kind of just like the weather they have to adjust to on a certain stretch. And this is some time when they're, you know, at sea and there's no wind and the ship is kind of stalled at certain points when there's not clear prevailing forces guiding the tour the way there used to be. I don't usually use nautical analogies, but like, it's sort of, you know, there used to be these big forces that they could sort of steer through and catch these various strong currents and go and be great. And now it's less clear. And there's just so many markers for me of where, and I'm not, and I don't use them synonymously. So I want to try to use them not synonymously here. Between women's tennis and the WTA, they're different things on a certain level. WTA is an organization that governs a lot of the tournaments, but it's not all women's tennis. And I worry more, honestly, about sort of capital T women's tennis at a certain level, because I just sense it really losing ground in tennis at a time when other women's sports are trending up, when women's soccer seems to be doing better, has a successful World Cup. It seems to get a lot of coverage, especially in Europe, with the European teams doing well. It seems like a big moment for that sport, and various pro teams, club teams in Europe doing well. Women's basketball doing well, both in the pro level and with Caitlin Clark, especially the college level, getting a lot of attention. It's women's hockey league that started up. I don't know how that'll do in long term, but it's starting up. There's at least momentum behind it. And the other side, I see the women's tennis, and the interest in it seems to be diminishing. And the way I measure that mostly is through these exos, which are just pure market events. They're not affiliated with anything. And there's all this buy-in and energy behind creating exhibition events right now in tennis. And they are nearly exclusively for men. They are, you know, you look at the Netflix slam, just men, even though the Netflix show in theory was a mixed show, the Breakpoint show. UTS had women, I think one instance, they tried women's once, but then otherwise it's been all men. Six Kings, the Saudi exhibition event, is Kings or men, and it's just men. playing there, playing for a lot of money. The amount of money on the table for that event is enormously huge. Laver Cup, Tennis Australia, and that's why I say it's not just WTA. Tennis Australia, which is one of the other stewards in theory of women's tennis, as a slam, should be equal for both in theory. They made a men's only event, and they partnered with ATP later on to get it going. And there's just no comparable buy-in or interest from promoters or organizers for women's tennis. And this is also concerning at a time when, okay, also, the other thing we haven't mentioned, there's a lot to cover, fuck, in this episode. The Saudi Arabia stuff, this deal that the ATP announced about the Saudi Public Investment Fund, PIF, spending $100 million for 5 years for the naming rights to the rankings, which are, and other sort of visibility promotional-wise on the tour. This is in some ways a big story, in some ways not a big story. Like the actual, what they actually bought is really kind of meaningless. No one ever referred to the previous ranking sponsor ever. We never talked about Pepperstone on the podcast, who was the previous title sponsor for the rankings. And it's not, so it's a kind of ignorable thing on some sense, but it is a big cash infusion to men's tennis. And the women, we talked about in the show last year, they made this pledge, WTA did, to have equal prize money at all their tournaments by 2027, I think it was. But a combined events, at least, have equal prize money all the events then. And I don't know how that happens when the men are getting this much cash infusion and seemingly in the market is responding so much more to them and the women are getting less in the dust. And part of this is Saudi Arabia. I did a podcast, a lot more talking about Saudi Arabia and the stuff you're interested in with Alex Gruskin on his show, Crack Rackets. I can put a link or something there, or I'll tweet it at least. And one of the ideas I had is that maybe the best thing that Saudi Arabia could do to sports wash is to come in and close the pay gap for the women and say, announce that they're going to create equal pay. That was my sort of game theory conclusion at the end. It's the best move for the Saudis would be to do that because they have the money, certainly. I mean, they spend so much money on so many other things in sports. They could afford to close this pay gap as big as it is in prize money at the events. But yeah, it just that, seems like
about
it would be very washy. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
No, I know.
But they would have to actually value women.
I know. But they could act like they do, even if they don't. That's the thing. I mean, how cynical is any of this? I mean, the how much, you know, what, anyway. But I just think that the women are in a tough spot, right? Because they're not trending up. They made this pledge, which I, at this point, would be surprised if they kept to have equal prize money by this year. And the men are leaving them in the dust in the money and the marketing front. And I don't know that there's signs of it getting better. And again, it's not all within their control. There could be a breakout star. If Emma Raducanu wins Wimbledon, maybe that floats all boats. I mean, you never know like what it takes, what kind of eventualities can happen to shift the landscape suddenly. But yeah, what do you make of women's tennis and where it's at now? And WTA is part of it, but I also think it's, like I said, I don't think WTA and their leadership is solely the only one at the wheel here.
Yeah, I agree. It's not all in their control. And as we talk about, often tennis needs stars that to sell the product. But I do think that there are basic things that the WTA can be doing to better promote, sell, market their product, which they clearly are. We've had this discussion before about how you know the contrast between the social media presence of the WTA and that of the ATP and Tennis TV. I'll just say, sorry, or you want to go?
Well, I was going to say, that's one thing I actually had been thinking and didn't say, is that I actually think that the prize money equalization thing is easy for me to say, it's not my money, but should not be the priority.
Where
to spend money for women's tennis right now, for me, it's not in just more money for players, because is that really a good investment to pay players who are already making plenty of money in the top 100, who are making livings in the top 100, to get them even more money when it could be spent on promotion and ways to grow the sport and grow the profile and some equivalent to Tennis TV. And Tennis TV, I mentioned a lot in this conversation, but I think what ATP has in that partner has really been huge for growing and creating social media and stuff, and women having their own version of that, or buying back into actual Tennis TV, which used to be a mixed product back in the day, whether that's some sort of merger talk or whatever it is, just on the Tennis TV front. I mean, yeah, I think the money could be better spent on things besides just prize money right now. I think prize money is actually a bad investment.
I agree. And we think back to when they actually did split from Tennis TV, and
they had no streaming.
They had no streaming, but they were promising that it was going, you know, it was coming and it was going to be great. And we're many years past that, and they still don't have an app. They still don't have, they don't have a WTA TV active social media presence. They've they've not done anything with it. But and I guess we should, to be charitable, this is technically, this year is under new management with the CVC deal. I mean, the entire reason that there are now more 1,000s and 500s, and they basically, you know, they're letting the 250 sink is because of this new strategy on with the CVC deal and the WTA Ventures, and you know that things are different at the WTA now. So from the, you know, the stance of how they market and sell the sport, we'll see if anything changes. But at the moment, I am in the same kind of place as you are, just quite skeptical, and just it's not great right now. Things, and I say that I think that the tennis is, this could be, I think on the court, this could be a great year. We could have, ignoring that result in Dubai, we could have Świątek, Sabalenka, Rybakina, Goff. What if Osaka comes back into the, you know, the field, if there's some other players who perform well, it could be a great fun year on the court, and with players who are able to kind of generate interest beyond just tennis fans. But at the moment, things are definitely in choppy waters, and it's quite concerning.
It is, and it's tough because, again, they don't control everything, and part of me just wonders how do I phrase this? If they believe in their product right now, you know, on a certain level, if they think I don't sense swagger from them. That's maybe a stupid term for it, but I don't sense they're like, man, you gotta get to know Rybakina, Sabalenka. Like, I don't really get the sense that they're betting on themselves in a certain way with what they have at their hand. I don't sense that. You agree with that or?
No, I agree. I think that comes back to what you were saying about them investing in prize money so that symbolically they're equal, rather than investing in the tour and trusting that eventually it's going to pay off and people are going to buy into it and it's going to generate interest and attention. And I do feel like we're in a different era in just in general, whether it's entertainment, sport, music, whatever, where you can have a reach on social media. There are ways to generate attention that weren't available to sports in previous years. But at the moment, it just feels like the WTA isn't doing any of it well enough to create fans who are interested in players, you know, to create people who see Ostapenko and are like, take advantage of what they do have, which is still, it may not be Serena Williams and Maria Sharapova, but there are still, it's still extremely entertaining and interesting.
There's appeal to this. You can make it work with this. Again, like, have faith in the cast. And again, not all of it works. Some of it is just tough. And some of the certain personalities or players or certain countries, honestly, that are top of the game are tough to, you know, it's tough to, you can't go chase Sabalenka into Belarus as a market. You can't do that, you know, but like you can, or Kazakhstan even, is probably not the same situation, but it's like not an easy market to move into for popularity to support from Rybakina. Poland, yes, Poland is a country you should be able to do more with, but there hasn't really been that kind of, it's interesting, there hasn't been, like, as far as I know, like, you know, year-end championships bids coming out of Poland, which is kind of surprising. You think they could be a bigger player and that could be better navigated, but it's tough to say from the outside. But yeah, the prize money, I was looking up, you know, for as much as we talked last year and people still talk about Cancun, the tour finals there being a shit show, to use that word of the episode, Świątek made nearly $300 million. Sorry, not Świątek made nearly $3 million. That's a little high. Świątek made almost $3 million in prize money that week, right? Is that worth it? I mean, like, I guess that is, but no one was talking about that. Everyone was talking about how bad it looked, you know? And just like, again, like, again, it's easy to say with money that's not mine, but also people talk about money that's not ours all the time on this show. For me, I just don't think that the prize money arms race I don't think it's the right investment right now for women's tennis. I don't. I think there's more things about getting people to want. Like, again, that's why I started talking about exhibitions. Like, getting the world interested in women's tennis and investing in women's tennis. And there's, you know, signals, sure, where like Coco Gauff, you know, it's just on a Vogue cover, I believe, this month, and it's like making some steps, and that's important because tennis is so star driven, and there's been. But men's and women's, I think I said in 2023, I thought it was the fewest household names that had ever been active on tour in tennis history was in 2023. It was just Djokovic, basically, in the U.S. at least, and that's it. With Nadal out, Osaka out, Serena retired, Federer retired, and so on. Coco Gauff is maybe getting there, and it's important to have that because, yeah, you just have to find these right things. So anyway, we can talk about more, but it's a mess, and yeah, I just sort of I worry for the Republic when it comes to women's tennis, and as someone who has adored it forever and is rooting for it, I want it to be doing better than I feel like it's doing lately. Men's side results wrap to keep this relatively quick. Just going through results. Tommy Powell won Dallas over Marcos Giron. Hugo Humbert, we've mentioned, done very well. He won Marseille and then won Dubai later. Two titles for him. He's getting into the top 15 now. Yannick Sinner followed up his Australian Open win by a win in Rotterdam. Moving towards getting that number one ranking, which I think he's meaningfully in the hunt for if he continues playing well these next few months. Taylor Fritz won Delray Beach. Kyron Khachanov won Doha with a 250. Humbert again won Dubai. And then Demonar won Acapulco. And I skipped over the results. I want to talk separately about the Golden Swing, this South American swing, which I think is a really sort of fascinating, you know, sub-culture, sub-unit of the tour in some way, which kind of exists in a vacuum in a certain way, where basically you have these tournaments, this big collection of tournaments at this point. There's Cordoba, the 250, Buenos Aires, the 250, the 500 in Rio de Janeiro, and then the 250 in Santiago. So a four-week swing, pretty significant stretch of time, one 500 and three 250s, and they get very few top players. Alcaraz did go down there, and Alcaraz did play. Did not play well. He lost the semifinals of Buenos Aires to Nicolas Jarry, who wound up losing that final to Facundo Diaz Acosta, who I watched play in Australia, actually, against Taylor Fritz in the first round and played really well. And Fritz was, like, gushing about how good he thought Diaz Acosta was. So he's somebody to watch as a good junior and is making good results as a pro now. But, yeah, but then otherwise, with the exception of – and then Alcaraz, sorry, then Alcaraz rolls his ankle very early in his first match in Rio and retires from that match. And then Rio and Santiago are both won by Sebastian Baez, who moves up to being, I believe, number five in the race in the ATP currently with the strength of his results so far this year. Yeah, with the Rio win and the win in Santiago, he is, make sure I get this number right, going into Indian Wells, he is number six, or tied for five, because Rublev got his points reinstated. He's now tied with Rublev for number five in the race at 1,010 points, which is ahead of Djokovic, let's say. Djokovic is number eight in the race currently. But Baez did this with only having faced one top 50 player in the Golden Swing, and which was Cerundolo, who he beat somewhere. For me, this is like, I think it's fine. I think it's kind of a non-issue that there are certain tournaments that bump up the ranking of certain players that everyone had an opportunity to play and are there. If you want to play this off-peak thing, and maybe sort of this is all traditional hard court season between August and March, let's say, in the calendar. But I don't have a problem with the percentage. I know some people sort of roll their eyes at Baez being number five in the race with only one top 50 win. But what do you make of the sort of Golden Swing as a phenomenon in tennis right now? And Andy Murray, to mention him again, you know, tweeted like, yeah, unpopular opinion, but which is a very popular opinion. We all kind of wish.
Yeah, it's
a very popular opinion. We wish that there was like big tournaments there. But again, sort of following the money, going back to Saudi, mentioned the Saudis again, like, that's what this tour is going. Tennis is going to Saudi Arabia because they have money, not because they have tennis culture and players and passion. It's about money. It's not had the money to keep up in the global market right now.
Yeah, I think it's good that there's tennis in South America. I mean, I agree with Murray that ideally there'd be 1,000. If I had to choose a place, it would probably be Miami, the tournament that's already within a stadium, within a football stadium. American football stadium. I don't have much time for that anymore.
Miami has sort of branded itself at times as being
the Latin American slam of Latin America.
Yeah. And it is. I mean, culturally, yeah. Miami is. Yeah.
As you mentioned, these tournaments are open to everyone. If there's an opportunity for anyone who wants to go there and quote unquote take advantage of the fields, I think it's still tough. You know, playing a lot of clay courters who know the turf and know the terrain.
Big crowds behind them and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. We've seen Norrie did, of all people. I think he was like the first British player to ever play in Rio or maybe win a match. I don't know.
He won the tournament. He won. He won that tournament. Yeah.
Yeah. He made final Buenos Aires, lost to Alcaraz, and then beat him in the final of Rio. And he came back this year as well, although he wasn't as successful. But I'm like you. I'm fine with it. I do think it's going to be Alcaraz has in a way been a saving grace, just that he's there, because if he, you know, I imagine there's going to be some point when he stops going to the Golden Swing, right?
Well, I imagine bluntly that they spent their money on him. You know, these tournaments have a budget to get some kind of star player, and they spent it all on Alcaraz. And so for Rio, obviously, it's a brutal blow. But they also did have this great run with João Fonseca, the teenager who made a run there at the tournament. I think he made quarters or semis, one of those, losing to Navone, the Argentine. And so a bunch of players we just don't see. And it's sort of like, again, watching like parallel dimension tennis. Like here is, you know, these crowds going nuts for Fonseca and Navone. And like, these are not players. These are not names we've said on this podcast before, meaningfully, but they're filling a stadium in Rio and having crowds go nuts for them. And it's great, you know, great. Yeah. Like, hooray for tennis. Like, you know, like it's all good. And yeah, it would be nice to see the top players kind of have to go down there, have it be like a mandatory event or a Masters event that really got the top players to show up. Because those fans, I hate this word in tennis, but kind of deserve, you know, some top flight stuff. We see the kind of crowds they get when like Federer or Nadal play exhibition events in Latin America. It's enormous. And yeah, you know, would love for hell the Saudis to host the way that Live, you know, was a golf tour that took place mostly in the U.S. From the Saudis. Like, why not have it'd be cool. It's not going to happen, but it'd be cool if the PIF events, whatever they wind up being, were in South America. You know, South American tennis, Saudi money with South American culture, would be a good combo.
You know, I'd want in a perfect world where money wasn't an issue, nothing, no problems whatsoever. A grass event in Rio in the middle of the grass court season. The grass Masters 1000, the grass WTA 1000.
Okay.
Random, but
to go to Rio between Paris and London, you're saying? Just geographically flip down to Rio.
Why not? Why not? Sure. The calendars are already a mess. Why not?
Yeah, that's fair. No, but it would be good to get something. And obviously it's just tough because like there's all this talk we do in this podcast and other people do too about like what tennis ideals would be and the whole world of it. And you know, tennis does not, these forces don't always have autonomy, don't get to pick exactly what they want to do, you know. You don't get to say, oh, it'd be great if there's a tournament in X city and just manifest it that way. It takes local investment, it takes a sanction, it takes lots of different stuff. You know, there's big cities, you know, that haven't really, you know, even in the U.S., certain cities like Chicago or, you know, Houston or Dallas. Well, Houston, Dallas don't have tournaments, but there have been big cities before that Philadelphia doesn't have a tournament. You know, there's like other places that don't have big events and, you know, certainly lots of other world cities you could think of that don't have many events that could. And just sort of, it takes local money. And again, it's all about money in the end. And so, yeah, I'm just curious to see what this Saudi arrival into the sport means and how disruptive it winds up being. Because because the deal that John Wertheim, I think it was, reported as $100 million for 5 years to this deal from PIF. But the amount of money they've paid to individual golfers is so beyond that. If they really want to make a move in tennis, they can throw around the kind of money that can really move mountains in the sport and can make some things that seemed very stuck, very unstuck quickly. And that's the kind of, that's when people talk about what, you know, tennis having issues and conflicts of interest and competing interests and, you know, different seven kingdoms, what could unite them all? What could unite them all meaningfully is some absurd amount of money. That could be one of, like, the biggest force that comes in more than anything. Yeah. So we'll see with that power.
It does seem though that, I mean, that agreement is an indication that they are trying to work within the tennis system and not,
yes, they're not doing it. A live thing.
And so the next, obviously, as we've discussed many times, the next big thing is the WTA finals, and of course that's been in discussion for a long time, and we're still waiting for the announcement and confirmation that it's going to be in Saudi Arabia, as I think a lot of people are anticipating. And we'll also see how much, if that does transpire, how much money the Saudis will be committing to the WTA.
Like I said, I think that option for them to make to say, hi, we are Saudi Arabia and we are closing the pay gap for women. That's gonna be tasty for them, right? They have that kind of messaging. Like, put their money where their mouth is. If this is where their mouth is, they're saying, they're talking a game on respecting women and having, you know, working towards rights for women. You know, they have the money to actually back that up. See if they do it.
We'll see.
Good shrug there for the people listening on audio. There. Any other thoughts on anything intense? And this was a sort of wide ranging, longer than expected episode. But yeah, any thoughts on any other things going on in tennis? Thoughts on the Sunshine Double coming up? What you expect from these tournaments? From Djokovic being back? From
I mean, Nadal's.
Nadal's back.
At least for me, I think for me, Nadal's a big thing. We just talked about Murray.
Oh, we glossed over it. But what did you think of the Netflix slam? That whole scene.
Oh, I mean, I thought it was good. I thought it was. I mean, it was positive. They clearly threw a lot of money into it, both in terms of the production. The way it was, you know, hearing from Agassi is always nice. And
getting Roddick to leave his house.
Yeah, exactly. Getting Roddick to leave his house. It also did well, unlike Breakpoint, it was like the first A1 banner on Netflix. Was top 10 in a few countries and people were watching it. They also flew in like celebrities, clearly. Quite a few celebrities from both Spanish celebrities and just Americans.
Yeah.
And so I think it's good. It's good, and I think it's an indication, as kind of we've heard for a while, that Netflix wants to get into live sports, and tennis is cheaper than most.
Yeah, it's a good point.
When you pay, you only have to pay two athletes, instead of, you know, whole teams, and whole leagues even, to facilitate them coming to facilitate these events. But yeah, I think it's a good thing, and it seems like it might. There's indications that it might come back again, but I think, as you said, it would be nice if the female players were involved as well, and Goff versus Osaka
some permutation of the, I think, three biggest stars in women's tennis right now, and this includes like marketability and popularity, are Swiatek, Goff, and Osaka. And I think any combination of those three players could have been a worthy second billing or undercard, if you want to say that, to Nadal Alcaraz, right? Like, you could have put that, they could have done that, and they didn't do that. But it's an interesting, I was thinking about in the context of this week, is about sort of the economics of exos. Like, it's a very attractive thing, you know, for something like Netflix to do, to say, hey, instead of trying to get a sanction and trying to get a tournament, all the red tape and everything, put up a bunch of money and do an event how we want to. And we can spend money on things like Agassi and Roddick and fly in celebrities and having much higher video quality than the tour streams do on their broadcast, for example. That was striking. And then, but not spend money on some of the things that honestly hold tennis back, like doubles, you know, like paying all these extra players, honestly, like, accommodating lots of players who aren't the ones who are putting butts in seats. And so as tennis is talking about premium and like big events, I think this Netflix slam and Six Kings, which I don't know if it's going to be any success in terms of crowd or viewership, but those are the events that are kind of actually walking the walk on let's just have the stars and have them be an outsized part of the sport, which is not good for the sort of job creation, you know, agitators in tennis, but I think does make business sense a lot of times for companies like Netflix. And yeah, if Netflix got in the streaming game, and you're right, it is cheaper than other sports, if they became a global streamer of tennis, I think it'd be great. And they would also show a commitment to them beyond whatever they're doing with Breakpoint, which I think has still been underwhelming as a product. You're nodding. I'm agreeing. Let's wrap up the show before, but any other thoughts on Sunshine Double to leave there?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is Nadal and how he fares. He's big thing with the clay court season. And obviously his future is up in the air. I think it's kind of a similar thing to Murray. I think if he's playing well, if he's doing well physically, I think he'll want to continue. But if in the next few months he gets the clay court season and there's still injuries and he's not playing and, you know, it's not happening, then we could be, it could be a repeat of Serena and Federer retiring within weeks of each other, just with these two players who have been playing each other since they were kids.
Yeah.
So these are significant weeks ahead, and I think that's the biggest thing. And I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot of storylines over the next couple of tournaments that,
So we'll be back to you with some sort of report on the Sunshine Double as it unfolds, and the Halep ruling, again, to circle back to that where we started this episode long ago, and whenever the details come out on that. Yeah, the tournament for the women. Yeah, interested to see again, like, if we get a result like Świątek Rybakina that seems to clarify things at the top, and that, or if we get some other result that feels more, for lack of a better word, random, you know, like, or unexpected. You know, like, even last year, like, we had Kvitova won Miami kind of out of nowhere last year, who was an established player, but not someone who had really had been doing a ton before after that to sort of lead up to that result. So, yeah, curious where it goes. Wow, looking at the draws, the last time Nadal played Miami, he beat Jack Sock in the quarterfinals, so it's really been a while. And with that, we'll see you guys later. Thanks for being on here, Tamani, and hope you all
enjoy the tennis. Thank you for having me.
Bye, folks.
See ya. Bye.